Well, some may feel that China is on its way up in the world, but my next guest says that things could turn very dramatically downwards for the entire Asian region. Michael Auslan is here, author of the brand new book, The End of the Asian Century, War, Stagnation, and the Risks to the World's Most Dynamic Region. He's also the resident scholar and the director of Japan Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael, great to have you on WILS.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
And in your view, how stable is China right now?
I think it is far less stable than what we have come to believe. I think the golden age of Chinese growth, which was spectacular and which we all should acknowledge, is entering middle age, at least, and that the future is going to be much harder and much more bumpy for the Chinese than the past has been.
Why so?
Well, you know, part of it is precisely the success that they've had, the enormous growth in just less than a lifetime. It's almost unprecedented in history, but when that happened, there was a huge amount of weaknesses that were papered over and new problems that were created, problems with the environment, problems with malinvestment, meaning that investment was directed in the wrong ways, labor problems, problems with intellectual property rights, all sorts of things that are now, in a sense, reaching maturity. So we've become used to, over the past 25 years, let's say, we've become used to one story about China, this relentless growth, a China that might take over the world. When you go to China and you talk with folks there, from government down to the cab drivers, they will tell you instead about the fragility of the system and their worries about the problems that aren't being addressed.
How much of it is that they're run under this communist regime?
Well, you know, that's the irony of it, is that the regime, which is certainly not a regime that I in any way endorse because of its brutality and it's the fact that it's not democratic, but it was incredibly successful in modernizing China, and we have to recognize that. Mm-hmm. But what it didn't do was take China to the next level, the level where individuals could make their own choices, where there was social trust that allowed them to become entrepreneurs, to have the protection of law, where foreigners could go freely to trade and live if they wanted. And all of that is because the communist regime is obviously not a legitimate regime. It does not have the support of the people, and therefore it must always keep control. And in doing so, it has actually warped Chinese growth and has caused the problems that force it to clamp down ever more strongly on civil society.
So is part of what China has to go through, does the regime have to fall then? Is that it?
Well, you know, that in when you talk about China, the idea of the regime falling would be a world-shaking, catastrophic event. What we all hope is that the regime evolves, that it recognizes that the what is best for China, and indeed what would be best for its own interests in an evolution, is that there would be more representation, that there would be more freedom, that religious minorities would not be persecuted, that babies would not be aborted, and the like. Okay. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of evidence that the regime is thinking that way or accepting it. And in fact, we see the opposite. We see a regime that is more paranoid, that is cracking down more, and therefore it just might be faced with a complete revolt at some point in time. It's the people, potentially the military, possibly. We don't know. And that's really what we want to avoid. So what I argue is that China needs to undertake reforms. It needs to figure out a way to sustain its growth, but get a society developed that has more participation and more freedom.
Talking to Michael Auslan, author of the new book, The End of the Asian Century. How likely are we to go to war with China, do you think?
I don't think we are likely to go to war with China. I'm afraid that an accident could propel us into an armed conflict.
Like what kind of an accident?
Well, certainly one in the South China Sea between our ships. Look, just last month, China grabbed one of our underwater drones, that's American property, out from under the noses of one of our Navy ships. You know, all it takes is a miscalculation where they knock a sailor overboard, where they accidentally ram and sink a ship. Back in 2001, one of their fighter pilots knocked one of our surveillance planes out of the sky. Luckily, none of our people died. The Chinese pilot did. Today, China is more belligerent, it's stronger, it's more active in those areas where we have sworn to uphold freedom of navigation because that underpins the global economy.
So do you feel the leaders of China are looking for a fight?
I don't think they're looking for a fight, Michael. What I think they're looking for is to be recognized as the big dog on the block. They want us and they want the other Asian nations to recognize that China is the hegemon and that we have to essentially change our policies to suit their interests. And we're not willing to do that, rightfully so, because they don't believe in the freedoms that we believe in. They don't believe in cooperation internationally. They support regimes like North Korea, which are a menace to international society. Mm-hmm. So what they want is for us to be scared and to say, you know what? We can't challenge them. And unfortunately, we've been doing a little too much of that lately. Yes. And all that has done is embolden them.
How do you see them reacting to President Trump?
That is the great question. That is something that they have never encountered. They don't know how to deal with it, although I'll tell you, most people in Washington, D.C. don't know how to think about it either. I think first that they are going to, they've been quiet. They haven't made too much reaction. But what I think they're going to do is start pushing back. They've already said that if he launches a trade war, they're going to strike back. And if he really militarizes or increases the U.S. military presence in the South China Sea, they're going to strike back.
But let me ask this, Mike. I've talked to economists who said, look, we're already in a trade war, except we're not fighting. They're just beating us up. Do you agree with that?
Right. I don't think that that's exactly the case. There's a lot more that we should be doing to protect our international property. I think the currency situation is more complex. It really reflects weakness in China rather than strength. And so I don't think we need to label them a currency manipulator. What we have to do is recognize that this economy is slowing down. Mm-hmm. We may be looking for other markets and other partners. But I think that President Trump is right to basically call reality, to say that things are unfair, that China takes advantage, that they don't share our values. I don't think you do it solely by tweeting. What I think we need is stronger policies to protect our interests. Mm-hmm. And we've lost a lot of ground. We should have been doing these things earlier where we were saying, you can't just start taking territory from others. We're going to support these nations because once you start, you won't stop. So there's a lot of different elements that are economic and
political. Does it take a military confrontation to stop them?
I don't think it takes a military confrontation. I think it takes a very clear policy. But let's admit it, and I think President Trump is admitting it, we've fallen behind. It is harder now to hold the line because we didn't when the risks were lower. The risks are higher today. Mm-hmm. I'm worried that we may miscalculate and think that the Chinese will back down when they find it impossible to back down because they will lose all credibility. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the answers are not as easy once you decide that you're not going to do things early on. So I don't think we need a military confrontation.
How do you see China making out in a military confrontation with us?
In the short run, they would not do very well. But let's not forget, it is a very long way for us to get over there. It takes weeks. And they can do a lot of things that make it difficult for us to go over there. Not to mention if the American public would support it. So the long run is what's dicier. They're willing to wait longer periods because they figure if it ever came to a conflict, we'd give up. We would say it's not worth it. And that's why I think it's very important to maintain our alliances, our partnerships, and our military presence there so that China doesn't get to that point where they say, you know what? It's not worth starting it, because if we reduce our presence, they may think, you know what, we can try this. We may be able to elbow them out of the South China Sea if we intimidate their ships. That's why it sounds like we're being belligerent, but it's really not. It's because we want to maintain peace in the region.
Michael Auslan, the book is The End of the Asian Century. The economic outlook then, for in your view, for Asia, at what point do you see things really turning downward dramatically for them?
Well, I think we're getting there. You know, the reality is China's economy has slowed dramatically. It may also already be in outright stagnation. Countries like Japan have not been able to get out of their stagnation. Other countries in Southeast Asia have very fragile economies that grow and then slow. I think the golden era for Asia's growth is over, and I think we should accept that. We have to get used to an Asia that grows at a far slower rate than today, that the opportunities will be there, but they won't be as much as we've thought about. Mm-hmm. That's one reason, Michael, by the way, that I think we need free trade agreements. I think we need a free trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that President-elect Trump is against. Mm-hmm. But I think it does need to be transparent.
You supported the TPP?
I do. I think in the, what TPP actually did was remove an enormous number, 18,000 different tariffs on American goods. Mm-hmm. It reduced non-tariff barriers. It allowed for more American agricultural products, cars, telecommunications and the like to compete in Asian nations that had kept their barriers up.
Yeah, but I talked to experts who said there were all kinds of other provisions where foreign governments could sue even local municipalities here in the U.S. that it actually superseded the our own government somehow. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think, look, the problem with the pact is that it was enormous, enormously long and complex. I don't know necessarily that issue. American law should never be superseded by international law. There is give and take that you have to give, that there may be arbitration mechanisms and other things. But the truth is, our economy is already very, very open. We have almost no tariffs and very low barriers. What this did was get us into those markets where we can, first of all, find new markets, but also help stimulate demand in those economies because our products are better and cheaper.
No, but is it their own countries and their policies that keep our products out? I mean, couldn't they readjust their policies on their own?
Well, sure, they could, but we needed to negotiate it away. You know, Japan, for example, has 40% tariffs on American cheese, 21% tariffs on American soybeans. And we export over $1 billion of beef to Japan per year, actually over $1.5 billion of beef, even though the tariff is 36%. TPP got rid of all of those tariffs.
Okay, so with Asia going down, are we just going to turn our attention to another part of the world for additional trade?
So that's the interesting part. Where else could we look to? Europe is slowing down. Africa's not an answer. Latin America has some opportunities. I think the point about free trade is that what we want to do is make goods cheaper, more plentiful, more available in Asia so that we actually spur demand, because that's really still where the growth is. If you go to trading blocks, if you go to raising tariffs, it's going to harm everyone's economy, ours included, but it will impoverish the Asian economies. So if we don't have a TPP, at least we should be looking at bilateral trade agreements, like President-elect Trump has said. Mm-hmm. That's the minimum, and we should do one first with Japan. But TPP would be better.
Yeah. Are they more reliant on us than we are on them?
I think overall the Asian nations are. Certainly China is. China cannot find another market for its goods like us. And that's why when they threaten us, you know, with economic disruption, you know, that's a bluff we should call. Mm-hmm. We can find other markets. They may be more, they may not be as beneficial. It may raise prices a little bit. But it's the developing economies of Asia, which include China, includes Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, they really do need us. Hmm. TPP was a good first step at getting us into those markets. Sometimes I think you need to throw your political weight around, especially with China, to say, you know what, you're going to be harmed more than we are. Don't call that bluff.
Well, okay, one last thing. Why do you think TPP then went down?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. One, you know, the recovery here is still so sluggish that the argument that we would lose jobs to Asia really resonated. The truth is, a lot of the jobs that went to Asia were not going to come back here. But more importantly, what we were exporting are things that the Asians themselves didn't make. They're not making all of the high-tech goods. They can't do the agriculture the way that we can. So this was actually a benefit and an opportunity for us. But the argument was we'd lose more jobs.
Right.
I'm not so sure that's the case. Those jobs have already gone. Some of the manufacturing and the and the textiles.
Michael Oslin, his brand new book, The End of the Asian Century: War, Stagnation, and the Risks to the World's Most Dynamic Region. Michael, great to have you on WILS. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.